From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with Los Angeles Times financial reporter Douglas Franz. His new book, Levine & Company, is an in-depth report on the recent insider trading scandal on Wall Street. Also today, I talk with actor Stephen First. He played Flounder, the brunt of John Belushi's jokes in the movie Animal House. These days, he's Dr. Elliot Axelrod on the TV series St. Elsewhere. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews cellist Yo-Yo Ma's new album. And Jan-Harald Brundtvand debunks another urban legend, this one about the woman who spent too much time at the tanning salon. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The insider trading scandal that continues to shake the financial community has also changed the popular perception of Wall Street. The image of buttoned-down Ivy League propriety has been replaced in the public mind with one of unbridled greed. My guest is investigative reporter Douglas Franz. His new book, Levine & Company, Wall Street's Insider Trading Scandal, documents the rise and fall of one of the ringleaders of insider trading, Dennis Levine. It also analyzes the changes on Wall Street that made insider trading possible. On May 12th of 1986, agents from the Securities and Exchange Commission arrested Levine and charged him with multiple counts of insider trading. According to the SEC, Levine had in the space of 5 years amassed a personal fortune of $12 million by trading on privileged information he gained in the course of his work as an investment banker. Shortly after his arrest, Levine told federal agents he shared some of his information with Ivan Boesky, perhaps the biggest single trader on Wall Street. Levine is now serving a 2-year prison sentence, and Boesky is about to stand trial. My guest Douglas Franz worked for 8 years as a financial reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He's now a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Doug, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Why don't we start with a lay explanation of what insider trading is?
Sure. Insider trading is the buying and selling of stocks based upon confidential information about a pending corporate transaction. That's something that will affect the price of the stock in a corporation. Where we find it most often is in when somebody gets advance word that company X is going to launch a takeover bid for company Y. What always happens when those bids are announced is the stock of the target company goes up. Sometimes it goes up enormously. We see stocks go up 30, 40, 50% overnight. If you get word of company X's pending bid in advance of everybody else in the public, you can go buy the stock in company Y at $40. When X's bid's announced and it soars to 60, you sell a stock, you've got an overnight profit of 50%. And it's not an exaggeration to say that that's precisely the kind of return Dennis Levine got on his investment in time after time. And that's the way he turned $40,000 into $12.5 million in 5 years.
Wall Street has always been a pretty closed community in a lot of ways. And one of the interesting things about Dennis Levine is that he basically pushed and shoved his way into this community and didn't initially fit at all.
No, he didn't fit with the traditional perception of Wall Street, particularly the traditional perception of investment bankers. The investment bankers have been the aristocrats of Wall Street. They're the blue bloods who come from Harvard and Yale and Wharton. And it was a very closed oligarchical society. But in the late 1970s, after stock brokerage commissions were deregulated and the revenue from the sales of stocks to, you know, small investors and even institutional investors declined, Wall Street had to find another way to generate money. They had to find another way to pay the bills, to pay the overhead. And what they found was that there was a lot of money to be made in the mergers and acquisitions business. Companies across America were beginning to expand by acquiring other existing companies rather than by building new plants. And that was the result of a convergence of complex economic factors. But what it provided Wall Street was a chance to make a lot more money in a new way. And so investment banks that previously had very small mergers and acquisitions departments suddenly wanted them to grow overnight into big profit centers in the company. And so they had to staff them with more people, and they had to dip a little lower in the barrel, if you will. And they were also at the same time looking, I think, for a more aggressive type of to bring somebody more aggressive into investment banking. It was suddenly a transaction-oriented, deal-oriented society rather than let's go out and have lunch and talk about our long-term relationship. You know, so the atmosphere changed, and it really opened it up for a guy like Dennis Levine, who came from a second-rate college, had a second-rate education, and as we came to see, had a rather strange upbringing.
What kinds of sources did he cultivate so that he could get the insider information that he used?
You know, it's really the best example of Dennis Levine's unbridled greed in that he picked up a lot of information about deals at the places where he worked, first at Smith Barney, then at Lehman Brothers, and ultimately at Drexel Burnham Lambier. He got information there, but he was never satisfied. He wanted to be on top of every single transaction on Wall Street. He wanted to get his greedy little piece of every pie, and so he developed sources at other investment banks. And ultimately, he had sources in four other investment banks on Wall Street, plus a major takeover law firm. And what he was able to do was bring his skills as a manipulator and as a con man to bear on some individuals who, while very intelligent, were also people with some personality defects, some emotional immaturities that didn't match their intellect. And he was able to lure them, I think, into his scheme. Not necessarily unwillingly. I mean, some of these people obviously were very greedy too. But Levine cast a wide net, and ultimately he found out not about every transaction, but a lot of transactions on Wall Street. And he was able to pick and choose the very best and most lucrative deals.
One of the secrets of his success was that he had a whole network of sources instead of relying on one source. Why did he do that?
Partly because of the greed, partly because he wanted to know about every deal. And there was the second motivation was that it was a way he felt if the Securities and Exchange Commission ever got on to him, it was a way of covering his trail, because once they started trying to track these trades, they'd find they didn't come from just one investment bank, but they came from three or four or five. And when you throw in the law firm, which can really mix up the sourcing, you know, you're left with a very fuzzy and befuddling trail for the government investigators to try and sort out. So he was really, you know, consciously covering his tracks was part of the motivation for expanding his base to this ring that he called the company, which is where the title of the book Levine and Company comes from.
And my guest is Douglas Franz, who's the author of this new book, Levine & Company, which is about insider trading. Now, what did his sources get in return for giving him tips?
They got various things. His confidant and real right-hand man was a fellow named Bob Wilkes, who was an investment banker at Lazard Frere in New York. And Wilkes, who started early, virtually the same time Levine did, had his own secret account down in the Cayman Islands, and he traded on a smaller scale, but he amassed his own money in this account. Ultimately, he made about $3 million. Now, the saddest story in this book may be that of Ilan Reich, who was a promising, absolutely brilliant lawyer at the takeover firm of Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz in New York. It's the richest law firm in New York. Partners make a minimum of $500,000 a year, and he had what everyone acknowledges was a promising career there. He was a real genius in this fine art. Ilan Reich never got a penny. He gave Dennis Levine information for 3 or 4 years, and he would he'd give him information, and then he'd back out because he'd start to feel guilty, he'd start to feel a little scared, then he'd come back in. Why did he do that? He wasn't getting any money. Why risk his career? Why jeopardize his life? Because Dennis Levine took him to lunch. Because Dennis Levine befriended him. Ilan Reich was the ultimate loner. He had no friends. And Dennis Levine befriended him.
That's what you mean by him knowing how to play the character flaws
of his sources. A very manipulative man.
Something else he did, he gave everybody a secret name. So it became like this big spy ring. I guess that made it more exciting
for everybody. Exactly right, Terry. It did. When I interviewed Bob Wilkes, and I'm the only person up to this point he's talked to in the press, and we sat in a hotel room for 2 days in New York, and he would get... Even after everything that's happened, I mean, he's been sentenced to a year and a day in prison, and 2 weeks after our interview, he went into prison. His wife was ready to kill him because she had known about this. His life is down the toilet, and yet when he'd start talking about it, he'd get excited again. The adrenaline would start to flow because it is very exciting. I think all of us may have a little bit of greed or a little bit of larceny in us, and you realize that when you take that risk— it's very exciting, and your life is really flashing before you, and your heart's pumping. And Levine created what I call a conspiracy of camaraderie, and he gave him these names like Lazard. Wilkes, who worked at Lazard Frere, was Lizard. Reich, because he worked at Wachtell Lipton, was Wally. Guy at Goldman Sachs was Goldie. You know, and it sort of added to the atmosphere, and it made it all sort of a game.
Say somebody wanted out of this insider trading ring, could they get out?
You know, it's not the mafia, and they weren't going to get hit if they got out. But Dennis Levine worked an emotional blackmail on them. As I said a little bit earlier, Alain Reich backed out occasionally, but he kept coming back because he was worried that Levine would, first of all, his thoughts were, well, he's going to blackmail me. He'll threaten to tell my law partners, and it'll ruin my career. But then when he thought about that, he realized that couldn't really happen because Levine would be cutting his own throat. And so what he came to realize was that he was suffering from an emotional blackmail. Dennis Levine wouldn't go to lunch with him anymore. Bob Wilkes tried to back out, and Dennis Levine said, Bob, I've always been your friend. I've always been your friend. Bob Wilkes's father had died when he was 20-year-old sophomore at Harvard. It upset him enormously. He had to leave school. He underwent electroshock treatments. He had severe depression. He was out of school for about 2 years. He got hold of himself. He went back and graduated from Harvard, magna cum laude. He spoke 5 languages. But Dennis Levine was always able to prey on Wilkes's fear that he might die or he might not be able to provide for his family.
One of the now infamous players in the insider trading scandal was trading information with Dennis Levine. And I'm thinking of Ivan Boesky, whose trial comes up soon.
Russian. Yeah, it's not his trial, actually. Ivan Boesky has already pleaded guilty to 1 felony count, and he paid the greatest fine in the history of American government, $100 million. What was scheduled for October 9th was his sentencing, but they've delayed it again, and I think they've delayed it because they're still trying to evaluate the quality of the information Ivan Boesky has provided the government attorneys in his cooperation.
Levine traded tips to Boesky. What was in it for Levine to give Boesky information?
It was really a classic criminal act. Dennis Levine, and we can put it in those terms, Dennis Levine fenced information to Ivan Boesky. Dennis Levine stole this information from his employer and members of his ring, stole it and gave it to Levine, and Levine sold it to Ivan Boesky, and Ivan Boesky used it to trade and make as much as $54 million on one deal. And Levine had in mind, he was very cunning and manipulative, although we know Ivan Boesky was predisposed to crime anyway. But Levine gave him a few early tips in early 1985, and Boesky made a lot of money on him. And then ultimately Levine came to him, I found out in the book, and said, what's in it for me? And so they haggled and they negotiated, and they ultimately came up with a formula under which Boesky was going to pay Levine 5% of the profits he made by trading on the tips provided by Levine. So now Dennis Levine is working this thing a couple ways. He gets money in his own account in Nassau with a Swiss bank. He gets money from Ivan Boesky a second way, and then he's always used this insider information to promote himself at work, to bring in some of these clients. I mean, if he learned from one of his Confederates at another investment bank that a company was looking at Company X out in California, he'd call up Company X and say, hey, I hear that you're about to get put in play. I hear that somebody is about to try and acquire you, and you better hire my firm to defend you. And he was successful in doing that several times, and it's one of the reasons he was rewarded at every step of his career on Wall Street, and he got more responsibility and more money.
What betrayed this ring to the Securities and Exchange Commission?
You know, the SEC has gotten a lot of well-deserved publicity as a result of this scandal, and they've been portrayed as a far more effective government agency than, in fact, I think they are, because it wasn't the SEC that caught him. It wasn't the U.S. Attorney's Office and the great Rudy Giuliani. He was caught as a result of an anonymous letter written to Merrill Lynch and Company in New York from Caracas, Venezuela. And for the first time, this letter is reproduced in my book, and it's a hilarious thing to read. It's ungrammatical. It makes little sense, but it was the first string that they pulled that unraveled the curtain, and behind it stood Dennis Levine, Ivan Boesky, et al.
There was also the lawyer for the Swiss bank in the Bahamas that had all of Levine's money. This lawyer also helped to turn the bank against Levine.
Yeah, what happened was the SEC, ultimately Merrill Lynch pursued this letter, and they found that several of their employees had been copying trades executed on behalf of Bank Loy, which is the Swiss bank in Nassau. And they couldn't go any farther. They couldn't pierce the veil of banking secrecy at Merrill Lynch. And so they kicked the case over to the SEC. And the SEC contacted the bank and began an inquiry. Levine was able, once again, through his powers of persuasion, charm, manipulation, to convince the Swiss bankers in Nassau that they should lie to their lawyers. And then their lawyers, in turn, would lie to the SEC. And a couple of smart, ethical, honest American lawyers named Harvey Pitt and Michael Rausch came down there. They were hired by the bank on Levine's recommendation because he thought if you can convince Harvey Pitt, Harvey Pitt will have an easy time convincing the SEC. And they never quite bought the story. And ultimately, they decided that it was, in fact, a big lie. And they did influence and pressure and sort of force the bank to come clean.
I think from the way you describe it in your book that Dennis Levine is the perfect embodiment of the old cliche that there is no honor among thieves. After telling all the people in his ring that they'd better not rat, he went and turned on everybody.
He sure did. I mean, after he was arrested on May 12, 1986, Dennis Levine really made the biggest trade of his life. He traded Bob Wilkos, Elon Reich, men who had befriended him, who had helped him. He traded Ivan Boesky in for a more lenient sentence. And he did it in a typically Levine-esque way. He'd placed his trades with Bank Loy by calling them Collect and using a code name. And he trapped Bob Wilkos with a telephone call also. He had told Bob Wilkos as short a time as 3 or 4 days earlier that I'm a stand-up guy, Bob, and don't worry because I'm never going to give you up. And then Wilkos gets a call late one night from Levine. Wilkos is in his apartment, and Levine's trying to draw Wilkos out about the scheme, and he's talking to him about it, and he's being very charming on the telephone. He spent his whole career on the telephone. And Wilkos, first of all, Wilkos is still stupid, and he's still trusting Levine. But second of all, he can hear the pay coins going into the phone, and so why should he be worried? What happened was that Dennis Levine was on a payphone in the United States Attorney's Office in Manhattan, and that telephone call was recorded. And once Bob Wilkos confronted that telephone call, he folded, and he helped Levine nail Ivan Boesky.
And it's because Levine turned that he got such a lenient sentence 2 years.
Absolutely. I mean, the judge, I was there at the sentencing in February 1987, and the judge said essentially that your crime deserves more. The maximum Levine could have gotten was 20 years. I think the judge either hinted or said that he deserved at least 5 years. But he said, we have to reward you this kind of cooperation. We have to send a message to people and tell them that they should cooperate with the government. And so he got 2 years. And it really amounts to a slap on the wrist, I think.
Do you think that Boesky will get more than a slap on the wrist?
No, because I think Boesky has cut his own deal. It remains to be seen, I think, how good a deal Boesky's provided for the government. And I think the quality of his information is still being assessed, which is one reason I believe his sentencing has been delayed. Boesky only pleaded guilty to one felony. Levine had to plead guilty to four. Boesky faces a maximum of 5 years. I don't have a crystal ball, but my guess is that Boesky's going to get about 2 years, about the same as Levine. I don't see how he can get less.
We're going to talk some more about the climate on Wall Street that made this insider trading scandal possible. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Doug. I was going to call you Doug Levine.
Thanks a lot. Don't mix me up with this creep, please.
Reporter Doug Franz is my guest, and he's the author of Levine and Company, Wall Street's Insider Trading Scandal. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Reporter Doug Franz is my guest, author of Levine and Company. There are codes of ethics on Wall Street, which have obviously been ineffective when it's come to this insider trading scandal. Why do you think the code of ethics has been so ineffective?
I'm not sure it even exists anymore, Terry. I mean, I don't want to be in a position of glorifying Wall Street ever in its history. It's a sordid past. They weren't called robber barons because they were Boy Scouts. But what had evolved, I think, through the 20th century on Wall Street was sort of an unwritten code of conduct. And part of that code was you didn't abandon a client if you were a Wall Street banker. and you didn't go after the clients of some other investment house, and you didn't misbehave, you weren't unethical, or else they would shun you. They would effectively put you out of the club. They could stop sending business your way. You know, it was a very effective way of enforcing the code. And there were bad things, too, about this. It was really an oligarchy, and it was a closed society. No women, no minorities allowed, and certainly very few Jews except at some of the important houses. What happened was that began to break down. As you know, we were talking earlier about this merger mania that swept the country and was really sort of became the new engine of profit on Wall Street. And when that happened, Wall Street became a far more transaction-oriented place. They were worried only about the next deal. There were no more long-term relationships between investment banks and their corporate clients. You know, it was really a more frenetic and more, it's a world where sharks exist. And it was a world where the guy who could move the fastest and react the fastest and close a deal the fastest was the guy who was making the most money. And so en route to that society, they abandoned the old code. It wasn't working anymore. They threw it out the window, and there was nothing put in its place. Instead, you know, all the rules were abandoned, and it became an economic free-for-all. It became, you know, sort of capitalism run amok.
You know, even so, I can't help but wonder how the brokerage companies could have seen these huge profits coming in from people like Boesky and Levine and not think that something fishy was going on.
Well, I think that if they'd taken the time and trouble to look up from the bottom line and ask hard questions about where Dennis Levine was getting his information, they probably would have come to some rather unseemly conclusions. But as you know, it's often a lot easier not to look, particularly when you've got a guy like Levine who's called a rainmaker, who's bringing in a lot of deals, and he's making money for himself and all his partners, quite legally. They had no, I'm not saying that they had any idea he had his secret account in Nassau, although I'll tell you that I think that there are a lot more people on Wall Street in high positions also who also have their own little hidden accounts in Switzerland or Nassau or wherever.
Levine's mentor at the college he went to gave him some advice that is a terrific, elaborate justification for self-interest.
Absolutely terrifying.
And I thought I'd read this get your reaction. This is Levine's mentor. He said, "Greed is a nice religion. If you're really greedy, you're going to keep your shoes polished. You won't run around on your wife or get drunk. You'll do whatever it takes to maximize your income, and that doesn't leave time for messing up."
That came at an important and impressionable time for Dennis Levine. He was the first member of his family to go to college. You know, he was really intent on making it. And he came under the spell of this fellow at Bernard Baruch College named Jack Francis, who had a little outside business as an investment, as sort of a small-scale investment banker. And when he told Dennis Levine this, Dennis Levine took it to heart. And Dennis Levine's response was to that little speech is, "I only want to make money." So in a sense, somebody Dennis Levine respected, a professor with a PhD, is telling him it's okay to be greedy, Dennis. You know, it's very similar to a speech that Ivan Boesky made in 1985 to the graduating class at UCLA Business School when he said greed is all right to great applause. I mean, you know, you should be thrown out for making a speech like that if you're a professor, and you should be booed for making a speech like that if you're a commencement speaker. But instead, it's indicative of the atmosphere on Wall Street. I think Dennis Levine, in some ways, was trained very well for Wall Street today.
Some people have made comparisons between the Iran-Contra scandal and the insider trading scandal because of people being out of control and working on self-interest. Do you think any connections? I don't mean that these people were in touch with each other, but do you think that the ethical violations are connected? That it says something about the climate of our country?
Well, yeah, I do. I do think it says a lot about the climate of our country. I mean, the Reagan administration philosophy is deregulation, is free enterprise, and it's the Reagan administration that spawned the Iran-Contra scandal, and I think it's the Reagan administration that has contributed to the atmosphere on Wall Street. It's a no-holds-barred, profit-at-any-price atmosphere on Wall Street today, and that's what happens when you deregulate everything. When you tell everybody it's okay, there are no more rules. You know, capitalism is a wonderful thing, and go out there and make as much money as you can any way you can.
Are the brokerage companies doing anything to try to revive their image?
I think they're hoping that this will go away. Dennis Levine was Wall Street's worst nightmare come true, and he's an extreme example of what's wrong with Wall Street today. But no, I haven't seen any great steps to make the kinds of substantive institutional changes that are required. There's a new definition of insider trading is pending in Congress now, and there's been some talk about trying to restrict the activities of corporate raiders. But I think that the real impetus for change has to come from the leaders of Wall Street. They have to recognize that if they don't clean up their act, and small investors are ultimately going to lose faith in the street.
I wonder what effect this has on the small individual investor, the person who wants to invest a few thousand dollars in Wall Street. They're going through a company because they don't know much about it themselves. Now they find out that there's all these sharks and all this underhanded illegal dealing there. It makes it pretty unappetizing.
Well, I would think it would. I don't have any money in the stock market, partly because of this reason. But in fact, I don't think it has, this scandal, I don't think it has diminished small investor interest or any investor interest really in Wall Street, because we're on top of this incredible bull market and there's enough to go around. The big guys can tilt the playing field in their favor, but there's still enough left for the small investors at this point.
Investment banking used to be, as you described it, a small community, basically a fraternity of Ivy Leaguers. And once it opened up, it kind of led the way for people like Levine to come in, who damaged the reputation of the whole profession in a way. Is this an argument for keeping it a closed community of blue-blooded aristocrats?
No, of course it's not. Of course it's not that. I said earlier that the rules set forth by this oligarchy were not all great. It has to be opened up. And in fact, it has been opened up. There are more women on Wall Street now, and you'll notice that in all this scandal, there's not been a single woman involved. No woman has been implicated. And you don't have to allow blacks and women into Wall Street with the fear that they're going to rob you blind. But what you do have to do is as Wall Street grows and as you open it up to different people, you have to instill in them some sense of ethics and standards. That's the responsibility, not to close the society up again.
Do friends of yours or people you've just met come up to you and ask you for tips since since they know that you're covering insider trading and that you're a financial reporter?
You know, everybody has a little bit of Dennis Levine in them, I guess. I was in a hotel down on Wall Street, the Vista International, and I was using a payphone in a bank of payphones, and I could hear the guy on the next phone saying, "Yeah, I don't think it's insider information. And you can buy up to 4.9% of the stock in that company." And I found myself leaning over thinking, what's the name of the company? What's the name of the company? I mean, you could make an argument that you're not hurting anybody. It's a victimless crime. And boy, I could sure make a lot of money. But what makes you and I different from Dennis Levine is that we've got some standards. We have some responsibility, some ethics, and we're not going to use that information because we know what's wrong.
Doug Franz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
No, thank you. It's been fun.
My guest has been investigative financial reporter Douglas Franz. His new book, Levine & Company, Wall Street's Insider Trading Scandal, follows the rise and fall of Dennis Levine, one of the financiers who traded unprivileged information. Levine & Company is published by Henry Holt. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with neurologist and writer Oliver Sacks. His book of case studies, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, has just been made into a theater musical, so I hope you can join us.
Romance without finance is a nuisance.
Well, definitely.
Baby, you know I need me some gold. Romance without finance just don't make sense.
It sure don't.
Mama, mama, please give up that gold. You so great and you so fine. You ain't got no money, you can't be mine. It ain't no joke to be stone broke. Baby, you know I ain't lying when I say romance without finance is a nuisance.
You're not kidding, brother.
Please, please, baby, give me some gold. Thank you.
Charlie Parker and Tiny Grimes' recording of Romance Without Finance. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, actor Stephen First, who plays the downtrodden Dr. Elliot Axelrod on St. Elsewhere, explains how for him, acting doesn't just pay the bills, it's a way to learn a bit of medicine. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album featuring cellist Yo-Yo Ma in performance with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. And our resident expert on urban legends, Jan Harald Brunvand, is back with a current story that's circulating about tanning parlors. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. Democratic presidential candidate Michael Dukakis said today that his campaign manager gave reporters the videotape that brought down the campaign of Senator Joseph Biden. But Dukakis said at a news conference that he refused to accept the resignation of John Sasso. Sasso has worked for the Massachusetts governor for 7 years. Dukakis said that Sasso admitted yesterday that he gave reporters a tape that showed Biden lifting sections of a speech by British Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock without attribution. Dukakis said he phoned Biden to apologize.
I spoke to Joe Biden a few minutes ago on the telephone. I want to publicly apologize to him and to his family, to his friends, and for the involvement of my campaign in this whole situation.
Dukakis said Sasso has been reprimanded strongly for what Dukakis called a very serious error in judgment. President Reagan today denied that he ever authorized the assassination of a Shiite Muslim leader as part of an anti-terrorism campaign. It was the president's first public comment on allegations contained in a book about the late CIA director William Casey. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Woodward, in his book Veil, The Secret Wars of the CIA, says that Casey had arranged, with Saudi help, to assassinate Sheikh Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah, leader of the extremist Shiite group Hezbollah. In March 1985, a car bomb went off next to the apartment building where Fadlallah lived in a Beirut suburb, but Fadlallah escaped. The White House denied that President Reagan ever authorized an assassination attempt on Fadlallah, and today, for the first time, the president himself elaborated on what he did approve.
It was nothing but that we were all approving a plan requested of us by the government of Beirut, of Lebanon, to help them in counterterrorism. Never would I sign anything that would authorize an assassination. I never have and I never will, and I didn't.
Referring to the revelations about Casey in Woodward's book, the president said there's an awful lot of fiction about a man who was unable to communicate at all and is now being quoted as if he was doing nothing but talking his head off. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
The president predicted today that common sense will prevail and that Robert Bork will be confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. Today, the Senate Judiciary Committee is holding its 12th day of hearings into the controversial nomination. Democrat Alan Cranston says the nomination is in trouble and, in fact, according to his count, is already licked. But President Reagan doesn't agree. He says when it comes time to vote, the majority of senators will agree with his assessment of Bork.
Just like my other nominees to the court, he's not going to promote my political views. He's going to apply a superb legal mind to the task of interpreting the Constitution and the laws of the United States. The support for him reveals the fact that he is superbly qualified, an individual of unsurpassed integrity, and a principled advocate of judicial restraint.
A simple majority of 51 senators will be needed to confirm or defeat the nomination. In the Persian Gulf today, five U.S. Navy warships escorted a group of military tankers on a supply run. The convoy sailed right past an area where British minesweepers hunted for mines for the third day in a row. A Pentagon spokesperson in Washington said the run was a routine trip. In Tehran, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament repeated a warning that a clash between the United States and Iran is inevitable in the Gulf. A Soviet cosmonaut is just about to break the record for space endurance. Yuri Romanenko has been in space on board a Soyuz 2M spacecraft since February 5th. The previous record was 237 days. By late today or tomorrow, Romanenko will break that record. The Soviets are trying to establish a permanently manned space station, and Romanenko's flight is part of that program. You're listening to National Public Radio. I'm Mara Liasson in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of a new album from cellist Yo-Yo Ma. Ma's been delighting audiences since he was five, when he gave his first public recital in Paris. Lloyd says that the strength and charm of Ma's solo performances are often diluted on collaborative recordings.
Among the current classical music superstars, there's at least one who deserves his status, who despite his celebrity still actually thinks about music, plays with both intensity and sensitivity, and with the kind of nuance that seems to have been forgotten by his generation. I'm talking about cellist Yo-Yo Ma, the kind of artist who makes you feel there's still hope for our civilization, even though his concerts sell out and his records are always on the charts. Unfortunately, except in the very limited solo cello repertoire, a cellist can't play alone. Concertos need orchestras and conductors. Chamber music needs collaborators. And with very few exceptions, Ma's recordings have saddled him with generally inferior partners. Naturally, his best album is the Bach suites for solo cello. His latest record is the latest disappointment. It's the Boccherini Cello Concerto, which is actually a loose arrangement of several Luigi Boccherini pieces by the 19th century German cellist and composer Friedrich Grützmacher. But it's the version that everyone knows and loves from the marvelous pre-war recording by Pablo Casals. The new Yo-Yo Ma recording on CBS, conducted by Pinka Zukerman with the excellent St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, is beautiful, but a little dull, bottom-heavy. Zukerman's rhythmic squareness keeps Ma hamstrung and rather glum, a real danger sign for a performer who can be so playful. Listen to a little of the opening. It's not bad, but then listen to the way Casals zips into this same opening solo, then turns suddenly, tenderly lyrical. Listen to the way he instantly builds phrases into musical sentences. This is from an old LP transfer, there are no CDs available of Casals playing the cello. Casals is having a field day. His conductor, Landon Ronald, was not one of the century's great musicians, but at least he kept things moving blithely and lovingly along. And the last movement contains one of Casals's most imaginative cadenzas. This is the kind of playing I expect from Yo-Yo Ma, the kind of playing I love him for. But on his own recording, he seems constricted, too earnest, almost anonymous. It's not that I think this new recording is a disaster. It couldn't be, but I'm afraid all these unbalanced collaborations are beginning to take their toll. The unreal, close-up toothpaste quality of the CD sound doesn't help either. Until I replayed the old Casals recording, I thought I just didn't like this music anymore. The new record also includes two pieces by Johann Christian Bach, one with Zuckerman joining in coarsely on the violin as well as conducting. The performances aren't particularly stylish, but they aren't the worst either. They just don't take flight. Who cares if the music industry chews up and spits out yet another run-of-the-mill prodigy? But I'd hate to see it turn an extraordinary musician like Yo-Yo Ma into one of its victims.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed Yo-Yo Ma's recording of the Boccherini Cello Concerto on CBS Masterworks. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is actor Stephen First. He plays Dr. Elliot Axelrod, the nervous, overweight, and insecure resident on the TV series St. Elsewhere. In person, Stephen First seems relaxed, self-confident, and not as heavy as the camera portrays, although he told me he weighs 225 pounds. In his first movie, Animal House, First was a fat, nerdy college student. These days, First likes to appear on college campuses to talk about himself, show outtakes from St. Elsewhere, and to discuss his TV character.
Elliot's a really good doctor and has great bedside manner. His biggest fault is he becomes too involved with his patients, which I don't consider a fault. I'd like to see real doctors be more involved with their patients, but he just lacks self-confidence, personal self-confidence, and just like everybody else, he wants to be liked by everybody, tries to be accepted by his peers, which is kind of like a natural human instinct.
How has the character changed in the years that you've played him?
Well, he's becoming slowly more self-confident and is not being taken advantage of, doesn't let himself be taken advantage of quite as much, and standing up for himself more.
How did you get the role?
Well, it's funny. It started out as a very small part, a one-day part, and it was five lines. And they added another scene in that episode, which That was great because now I had a nice little small part. And then about 3 weeks later, they asked me to do another small part, same character. And then about 3 weeks after that, they said, would you do another script? And I said, sure. You know, I'm not doing anything. I'm not going to turn down work. And the script came, and it was a large part. It was like one of the focal points in the script. And the third day of shooting, the executive producer, Bruce Paltrow, came down and said, how would you like to be a regular next year? And I was delivering pizzas, you know. So I said, well, I don't know, you know, the pizza delivery business is pretty good right now. But no, after I got off the floor kissing his feet, I said, yes, I'd love to. And I just happened to work out very well for me. I signed a 7-year contract with St. Elsewhere and, you know, everything's going great.
And what year is it now?
It's the 6th year for the show and the 4th year is a regular for me.
Now, how many years do residents actually serve?
For every 2 seasons, it's 1 year. So that covers us for 8 years.
So you're actually going to be playing a resident longer than any resident actually.
Right. Every 2 seasons is 1 year.
Plays his role in a hospital.
Right. I mean, we're in our 6th year. This may be our last year. Maybe go one more. We're not sure. We've never been sure on our show whether we were going to be picked up the 2nd year or the 3rd year or the 4th year or the 5th year.
Your character is so ambivalent about all the stress and pressure of medical school. In the premiere episode, I thought your character was leaving the series because he had gone to work at a used car dealership and was really seriously thinking of staying until the episode ended and he decided that selling used cars was even worse than being a resident. Was there ever any doubt in your mind that you'd return?
No, there's no doubt in my mind because I knew at that time of the filming that I had already been, you know, my option had already been picked up for that year. It's once again, it's just the storyline. He found out when he was not picked up by another resident program that he was making more money working less hours as a car salesman for his cousin Pee Wee. And so when the hospital reopened and they came to get him, he says, you know, he started to think twice about going back and working 36-hour shifts and having people's lives in his hand. And basically, of course, he started to get into trouble at the car dealership. He was accused of sexual molestation. And then he took somebody for a test drive who tried to kill him. And so he went back to the hospital.
As you can see, there's plenty of room for shuttling the bridge club around.
Yes, exactly the style I had in mind.
Feel free, climb right in.
Actually, I'm not interested in luxury. I need a van for the dogs.
Dogs, huh? What kind?
I'm sorry.
My father's a vet.
What's that got to do with anything?
Well, you see, I thought...
You must speak up. I've been having difficulty hearing.
Really? Did you check with a doctor?
No.
You know, the inner ear is an intricate mechanism. You know, loss of hearing can be caused by infection or buildup of cerumen. I really know what I'm talking about here.
Just because your father's a vet doesn't mean you can paw me.
I'm a doctor.
Help!
Really, I am. Don't scream. I really am a doctor.
Sure, that's why you're selling cars. You just wanted me in this van to have your way with me.
I just wanted to have a look.
Explain that to the police.
People are used to seeing you every week on St. Elsewhere, and they associate you with the doctor that you play. When you ever go to see a doctor to get examined, does the doctor relate to you as someone who plays a doctor on this series every Wednesday?
It's funny. They give me a lot more respect.
Do they really?
Yeah, and when I question them, they, you know, because I've really learned a lot of medicine doing the show, and when I question them and I throw out terms that usually only med students know or other doctors know, they get quite intimidated, which I kind of enjoy.
Your first movie role was in Animal House, which was a wildly successful movie. How did you get the part without any acting experience?
It was kind
without any movie acting experience.
No,
is
yeah.
What I mean.
Well, it was kind of difficult because like you said, I was a person with no credits whatsoever, and I was auditioning at a major studio, and basically it was John Landis, the director, who kind of stuck up for me and said, "I've auditioned this guy 5 times. He is the right person for the role of Kent Dorfman or Flounder." They said, "But how about," and they mentioned 5 other names, people who had done other movies and stuff. And John Landis stuck up for me. And, you know, thank goodness he did, because that really changed my life.
Have you, through your career, ever been offered stereotypical roles, stereotypical fat roles?
Yes, I not stereotypical fat roles. Basically, I can narrow it down to people. After Animal House became a hit, people kept offering me the youth comedies, which of course I took some of them because it was better doing something in the motion picture industry than waiting tables. So I did my share of B movies, you know, things that probably people have never seen, like Swim Team, and and I did one called Midnight Madness, which of course I wasn't alone. Michael J. Fox was in Midnight Madness with me.
I just always wonder if some roles, just as some roles say black person, white person, Hispanic person, if some roles say skinny person or heavy person.
Some of them say that and others don't.
Well, I think in movies there's this whole set of stereotypes that go along with being fat that include being stupid, eating a whole lot all the time, you know, always gorging yourself.
Right.
And also being either sexless or being the comic relief. The character whose sexual relationship isn't taken seriously.
Oh, well, you never see any kind of basically love stories involved. But, you know, that doesn't bother me too much. You know, character actors like me last a lot longer than the leading man, I think.
Well, that's an interesting point.
Men come and go. Occasionally, you know, people stay stars for years and years. I mean, we got Paul Newman and people like that who are leading men for years, but there's a lot of men who become leading men and they're successful for about 5 or 6 years.
Were your school experiences anything like either Animal House or Saint Elsewhere?
No, I basically had a normal childhood. I was doing, in high school, my grades were horrible because I was doing dinner theater at night. I was making like $22 a week doing, you know, musicals like Hello Dolly and Fiddler on the Roof. I think I've done Fiddler on the Roof like 12 times. And my grades really suffered. I graduated high school with a 1.7 average.
And I managed.
It is pretty low. And I managed to get into a college, and I was on the dean's list because I only had to take drama classes because I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts. And so I went from having a 1.7 average to having straight A's in college.
When you were waiting tables and when you were delivering pizzas,
right,
did you fear that you would be one of the actors who ends up being a waiter all their lives? There are so many people who never get out of the day jobs and who are never able to build that acting career.
Well, yes. But I had set a goal for myself. I was married, and I wasn't going to do that to my wife. I said, give me 5 years, and in 5 years, I'll get a career. I'll sell real estate, or I'll go into a business or something. You know, I wouldn't put anybody through that. You know, I wouldn't be that selfish to deny somebody a good life because of acting.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your acting.
Thanks.
Stephen First plays Dr. Elliot Axelrod on the TV series Saint Elsewhere. By the way, when the series returned this fall, Saint Elsewhere had been sold to a hospital group called Ecumana. Umana Incorporated of Louisville, Kentucky, which owns and operates hospitals, went to court to challenge Saint Elsewhere's use of the name, saying it's a copyright infringement. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we're following the confirmation hearings of Judge Bork. We think today is the last day of hearings, and we'll have a report from Nina Totenberg. Also, talk with a press critic about the ethical questions arising over Bob Woodward's new book on the CIA. This critic says all the journalistic ethics that have been pointed to are mostly sour grapes being raised by other newspapers. We're also joined right now by somebody who won't be on the program at all.
Hello, Terry. I'll be listening, though.
That's Scott Simon of Weekend Edition.
To what do we owe the pleasure of your company?
I was just walking by and the light went on.
Oh, great.
He's a tough guy to get.
Okay, well, thank you both. Stay tuned for All Things Considered, which is coming up from National Public Radio. Commentator Jan Harald Brunvand is an expert on tracking urban legends. Lately, he's been receiving reports about a girl who spent too much time under tanning lights.
The hottest urban legend going around is about a girl who wants a quick suntan and somehow contrives to schedule extra sessions at a tanning salon. The result, supposedly, is that she cooks her internal organs. The first person to tell me this shocker was a colleague, just back from teaching summer school at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He heard two versions. In one, a girl repeatedly visited the same salon at different times of the day. She began feeling ill, and she consulted a doctor who told her that she had cooked her insides. Version 2 claimed that she fried a muscle in one arm, and the limb had to be amputated. Next, a student in my folklore class reported the story. It supposedly happened, she said, to the wife of the cousin of the man who had told it to a woman friend of hers who then told her, or something like that. This time, she said, the tanning salon had a 30 minutes per day time limit to protect customers from overexposure, but the woman circumvented that by signing up at 4 different salons. Her husband began to notice that she smelled funny, and her doctor gave her the bad news. She had cooked herself from the inside out. Then another student mentioned that she was told that it had really happened to a girl who was asked to be a bridesmaid and wanted to get a really good tan. So I'm sitting there in my office with my notes, labeling a file folder, curses broiled again, and the telephone rings. The caller heard this awful story from someone at work. In her version, a young lady from a small town wanted a good tan before going to a cheerleaders' camp at the state university. She became another cooked goose. A second call came a few days later. This time the report was of a young lady going to Hawaii who wanted a head start on her tan. Apparently her doctor said to try to treat her condition would be like trying to bring a cooked steak back to life. Locally, I heard several more times both the cheerleader and Hawaii versions. I got a note from Milwaukee reporting the story going around in northern Wisconsin. I found the story sent into a computerized message network by someone at the Stanford Research Institute. On September 22nd, Abigail Van Buren got into the act. In her Dear Abby column, she printed a letter from a reader in Springfield, Oregon, who had received the story from her daughter at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. It was the Hawaiian version again, with a 17-year-old victim lying blinded in a local hospital with only 26 days to live. So Abby called the hospital, and she learned that the same unverified story had been going around in Pocatello, Idaho, as well as in Utah. Did this urban legend just come out of the blue, somewhere in a western state in the summer of 87? Well, I think that's too simple. I would trace one theme in the story to an earlier rumor about home tanning lamps. Supposedly, a woman fell asleep under a sun lamp and her contact lenses became fused to her eyeballs. All of these legends deliver warnings against technology. While accidents with appliances do happen, these horror stories floating around in different versions almost certainly have not happened. Perhaps another reason for the tanning salon story is fear of the actual danger that too much tanning increases your risk of skin cancer. The legend is a gross exaggeration. Also, it shows these bad results happening only to someone else, never to ourselves.
Jan Harald Brunvand is a professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah. Write us at Fresh Air with urban legends you've heard, and we'll pass them on to him. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with actress Mamie Van Doren, one of the blonde bombshells of the 50s. Some of her films have become cult classics like Born Reckless, Untamed Youth, and High School Confidential. She's written a kiss-and-tell memoir titled Playing the Field. Rock critic Ken Tucker will review Babylon and On, the new album by the British group Squeeze, and guest film critic Michael Schrago will review The Pickup Artist, the new James Toback film that stars Molly Ringwald and Robert Downey. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.